I'd like to welcome Ray to the platform. He's flown all the way from the East Coast of America. It's a long way. He serves on the Executive Committee of the Board of American Academy of Actuaries, and he's on the Resources and Environment Working Group for the International Actuarial Association. He's also the Chief Executive of FB Alliance Insurance, a US insurer charged with delivering innovative new products to Farm Bureau members in states across the US. He's devoted much of his career to examining public policy issues arising from extreme events. He has served as an editor on academic journals, authored numerous peer-reviewed papers, and spoken extensively on issues arising from new development in a rapidly growing world facing uncertain outcomes from global warming.
Thank you. Well, we've now laid the groundwork for how we can measure and identify what's going to happen. I want to talk a little bit about the effects of some of these things on various government systems and some things we need to do to understand this. I entitled this program Gaps because I want to talk about several gaps that I see in the future. I want to start with framing the issue and talk about some surprises that we continue to seem to have that we shouldn't be surprised at. I want to talk three gaps: a funding gap, a mitigation gap, and a mandate gap. And then I want to talk about closing the gaps. And no, I won't talk about minding the gaps. So, surprises. We keep getting surprised. We had a volcano go off in Iceland that shut down air traffic in Europe. We had Queensland go underwater, despite the fact that we had built flood control after the last Queensland floods to prevent this. But, of course, we were worried about droughts, and we let the dams get too full, and then we couldn't drain the water off fast enough, so we had a flood where it shouldn't have happened. We had a city go underwater in New Orleans, where it had been predicted for decades that as soon as a hurricane went through the area, the levees would be breached, the city would be flooded. We had New York City and Sandy, which went underwater. Long Island Sound, the bathymetry of Long Island Sound is such that you get a hurricane off the eastern coast of New Jersey, and it's going to push water in there just like a funnel and flood the city. It's been predicted for decades. And we have Harvey, which Richard mentioned, was a massive rain event. But it was a rain event made much worse by the fact that they concreted over the bayous and removed the natural drainage in the area and took a bad event and made it a catastrophic event. We can draw some lessons from these surprises that I'll come back to later. There's two I want to touch on. First, you know, risks are increased by the interaction of development and natural hazards. Harvey's a good example. Harvey would not have been so bad without the concrete. So when we think about what's going to happen with climate change and bad rainfall events or anything else, we also have to think about how that interacts with modern technology and modern building. The last two points are also important. Special interests inhibit adaptation. I was thinking when Tim was talking earlier about the mitigation measure on a house when you buy it, we actually implemented that in Florida, had it in statutes. The realtors killed it. It wasn't data, it wasn't anything else. They were worried about it making harder to sell a house. And so they deprived consumers of that knowledge. And that means we have to consider human behavioral tendencies as we think about these things. So, let's talk about some gaps. Let's talk about a funding gap. U.S. flood insurance and rising sea levels. I am not going to further cover too much on the National Flood Insurance Program, because John did a good job of that earlier, based on our earlier paper. But I will note two things on the flood program. First, or three, it was established in 1968 with these mandates: to promote mitigation, to provide affordable insurance, to increase insurance penetration, but to do all that in a fiscally sound manner. It's run large deficits, which have been almost entirely driven by large coastal storms, and it's currently being reauthorized. If you want any more information, the Academy of Actuaries put out a monograph last year, which I had the misfortune of being the lead author on, which means I know quite a bit about flood insurance in the U.S., more than I'd ever want to know, and that's available on the Academy's website. Well, Congress is in the midst of reforming this residual market, and it's come up with what I call the sort of usual prescriptions for how do you fix this thing that was $60 billion in debt after Harvey. And it does get back to the number John showed by some magic. Privatize. When in doubt, privatize it, right? So we'll just make the public problem go away by putting it in the private sector. Never mind the fact that the program's losing money and the private sector is probably not going to do the same. Increase the use of reinsurance. Make the losses go away, but don't raise any rates to pay for it. Modernize flood mapping. Invest more in mitigation. And when all else fails, simply forgive the debt. So they turned $60 billion into about $25 billion with the stroke of a pen and just deleted the debt. And, of course, that Congress and parliaments are good at that sort of stuff. The Academy of Actuaries, of course, had some more complicated answers. We suggested that you need to take a holistic view of the program. And the only thing I would disagree slightly with from this morning's session was that sometimes these programs are more than the profit and loss in the insurance accounts. You know, how much was saved by the flood program by pushing mitigation and higher elevation requirements? So maybe the $60 billion loss saved $70 billion of potential other government expenditures. We can't forget that. Clarify financing losses for megastorms. Make sure private sector flood coverage does not, screw the market up. And prepare for the impact of rising sea levels. We just heard about rising sea levels. Let's talk about those for a minute. This is the Actuaries Climate Index. I'll skip that because it shows what we recently showed. I grew up in New Jersey in the United States. This is the New Jersey shore using a similar tool than was showed earlier. And one other thing you have to remember about rising sea levels, it's not just about sea level, it's about land subsidence also. And for some complicated reasons, the east coast of the United States is actually sinking from about Boston to Virginia, which is also exacerbating the issues with rising sea level. There's about $1 billion of insurance on that island there. And that's what it may look like with some significant sea level rise by 2050 to 2100. Of course, all that property is insured by the federal flood program. And if you look around the United States coast, the flood program insures almost 1 million properties with a cumulative worth of about $600 billion within 1 mile of the coast. A significant proportion of that property will be damaged or worse in the next 50 years. And there is no way that they can possibly pay those losses with the revenues coming into the program. Somehow or another, that's going to go into the U.S. federal debt. And that's not the worst of it. After Katrina, the U.S. government spent $14 billion in defense in depth in New Orleans, which was the Army Corps of Engineers. During Sandy, the Army Corps of Engineers got Sandy, pardon the pun, by spending $500 million renourishing beaches to protect against the beach erosion that occurred in Sandy. There was dewatering of tunnels underneath New York that cost, hundreds of millions of dollars. Buying generators, because the power was out for long periods of time. Debris removal was a huge cost, again, borne off budget by the Corps of Engineers. And then we've got the U.S. military. The largest U.S. military base is in Norfolk, Virginia, where they're currently having sunny day flooding, due to, a combination of subsidence, sea level rise, et cetera. And the Defense Department is looking at substantial expenditures to protect the Navy base. And even NASA is spending money already to do planning for how they're going to protect the Space Center in Florida from potential sea level rise. So, conclusion, the U.S. is exposed to some substantial unfunded risk. There's an enormous inventory of coastal property that is exposed to flooding. Building codes and elevation standards do not contemplate future sea level rise. The process for making difficult decisions does not exist. There is no clear paradigm right now for when do you abandon, when do you rebuild, when do you protect. At the moment, that's just meant to be sorted out, I guess, as we move ahead. Government has large exposures to costs for insurance, recovery, rebuilding, and infrastructure, as we just saw. Currently, virtually none of this is budgeted for. And I ask the question, government routinely and actuaries do a lot of work thinking about age pensions, future medical costs, etc., over multi-decadal time horizons. Why don't we do the same thing for costs like this and force them into the budget and force them into long-range projections? This is going to be a major economic issue for the United States and many other countries across the world that may affect exchange rates, inflation rates, commodity prices. There's a whole lot of rebuilding that's probably going to be done over and over again. We're going to have more than one repetitive loss property like John showed. We may have thousands or millions of them. And the question is, where is that money going to come from and what effects are going to have on the economy? Secondly, I want to talk about a mitigation gap. And for this one, I'll ask you to bear with me for a moment because I will walk you through a thought experiment. And with absolute deference to the climate scientists here, I'm going to make a few speculations that may not be perfectly correct, but they're directionally correct. So again, I'll anticipate that what I'm trying to do here is a thought experiment, which applies very specifically to Australia. So this infographic, you can't really read it very well, but it's from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, or administration in the U.S., and it basically shows several things. First of all, substantial numbers of Americans live near the coast. That's also true in Australia. People are moving to the coast in significant numbers, possibly attracted by cheap flood insurance. And there's a high density of people living on the coast. Now, ocean temperatures are rising. This has been demonstrated. And we know that warm water fuels hurricanes. And at least off the east coast of the U.S., that warm water is being transported northward by the Gulf Stream, and it's creeping northward across off the coast of New Jersey and other places near New York. And the research does indicate that in the future, the northeast U.S. could be exposed to some very substantial hurricanes due to significantly warmer oceans. At the same time, the northeast U.S. has extremely old housing stock. You know, some of those houses are 50, 100 years old, and it has not been fortified to withstand hurricane-force winds. And even if strong codes were enacted today, it would take decades for the housing stock to become hardened over, you know, as it turns over and new things are constructed. I propose this is going to lead to a mitigation gap where effectively the wind hazard changes faster than the housing stock can be adjusted to withstand it, leading to a mitigation gap. One could argue we face a mitigation gap like that here due to bushfire or other perils that affect Australia. So, the second conclusion is that the U.S. is also exposed to substantial losses from this problem. There's significant uncertainty, but there is a high likelihood of future hurricanes impacting this housing stock that was not designed for them. We saw this happen in Florida. It led to a market meltdown, the creation of massive government pools. Building codes were strengthened in a fire drill or a pair-on-fire manner, and major effort was made to try to retrofit stuff that had been built wrong in the first place for the conditions. The problem in the Northeast U.S. is actually much larger, potentially. You got older housing stock and a much larger population. Will action be taken, or will the massive great hurricane of 2026 be yet another surprise that hits us like these other ones? Won't be a surprise. Y'all heard it here. When it happens, hopefully I will be back from the U.S. by then and will not be part of it. My third gap I want to talk about is the gap in building codes, which I call the mandate gap. Current building code thinking has been driven by structural engineers. And I gave this a version of this talk to a structural engineering conference, and they said, "Why are you talking to us? This is about economics, not engineering." I said, "Okay, whatever." But current building code thinking has been focused on life safety. It thinks about the current state, not the future state in most cases. And there's little consideration of macroeconomic issues when we develop codes. We think about, can you get out of the building before it collapses? Do we have a stronger building code if you're in a place with a million buildings around it versus out in an isolated area? In theory, you should have a stronger code because the losses are bigger in a place with a million properties. Our codes don't even consider that. So there's three lenses we could look at building codes through: life safety, protection of property, or macroeconomic, or minimizing macroeconomic disruption and increasing resiliency. Now let's think about what would happen if actuaries designed building codes instead of structural engineers. What might happen? Let's have some fun. Everything would fall down and blow up and we'd have to rebuild it every week probably, but we'd have fun. Anyway, let's think about economic mitigation. First thing we might do is assume the economic value of mitigation could be defined to be the present value of the expected savings and insurance costs over a building's lifetime, right? That's something we might think of doing. Fair way to evaluate whether it's worth raising the elevation of a house or installing reinforced garage doors or something else. Well, future insurance costs will affect evolving risk concentrations, climate change, and mitigation. We just saw in the last presentations that we have tools already in existence that can help us look into the future and understand the effect of climate change and understand what may happen to the hazards facing those houses so we don't have to plant ourselves in the present and ignore the future. Various future scenarios can be created and assigned probabilities, yielding a distribution of cost and benefits over time. We can think about things stochastically in the future. We can even use economic capital models and adapt them to simulate various future states to come up with an economic mitigation value. And finally, building code and land use decisions could reflect future conditions, uncertainty, and the cost-benefit of mitigation strategies. Now, some of this is starting to be done in various places. I can tell you none of this is being done in the U.S. We are currently elevating everything on the beach to basically where the sea level is expected to be in the last 20 years. And there's pretty high indications that everything we're building right now is going to be inadequately mitigated in the next 20 or 30 years. Almost certain, based on what we heard in the previous presentations. Now, some might call that rather insane thinking or willful neglect of the future or willful neglect of science. But it may just be simple economic interests of home builders, realtors, and local councils whose time horizon is measured in weeks, not decades. So, how do we close the gaps? Well, the first thing I wanted to do was ask whether any of this stuff I've talked about is relevant in Australia. And being a dual citizen and having an Australian passport, which is my escape from the U.S. if things get too crazy, I think I'm somewhat qualified to look at the two countries. And I will say, and I'm not saying this because y'all are, in Australia. I'd say this if I was in the U.S. I think generally Australia is ahead of the U.S. in thinking about these issues. The government has looked at a study out to 2050, looking at, potential resilience strategies. Even despite what the Prime Minister says about fires, I do think that at least the Treasury and other people are thinking about these things. And in the U.S., it's Trump, the first thing Trump did, the first executive order he issued, repealed an Obama requirement that future sea level rise had to be considered in infrastructure projects. And the question and answers, I'm only going to answer one or two Trump questions, if any. So be warned. So, is sea level rise and coastal inundation an issue here? Yes. We have a lot of people living on the coastal fringe. Do we have a government flood pool? No, not yet. Do we have an unclear process to manage adaptation? Well, despite the last session, I think to some degree we still do. How are we going to decide when we abandon property on the beach? How are we going to decide whether we're going to build massive seawalls and invest billions of dollars in coastal protection? I'm not sure that's sorted out yet. You guys may disagree. We can talk about that later. Is the government exposed to large expenditures from this stuff? Well, I remember the income tax surcharge to pay for our friends up north in 2013, I think. So, yes, I think the government is exposed to expenditures. Is there some exposure to the poleward migration of cyclones? Could Brisbane's risk of severe cyclones go up without adequate wind mitigation in the building code? Is there a potential mitigation gap? Yes, I think there is. Think about bushfires and the rapid increase in bushfire risk due to high heat days. And is there a need for rethinking building code development? I say yes. Again, maybe you guys would say no. So what's required to tackle these problems? And this will be really my last slide when we get to Q&A. So I think the first thing we have to do is learn from surprises so we don't keep getting surprised. You know, there was no excuse. The year before Katrina hit, there was a Hurricane Pam exercise where FEMA simulated Katrina in a scary way. I remember standing in New Orleans addressing a Casualty Actuarial Society meeting in May of 2005, four months before Katrina hit, saying at some point the hotel we're standing in will be underwater. Little did I know, it will be 4 months later. So we've got to learn, we've got to listen to people, and we've got to see obvious risk coming and deal with it. And importantly, we've got to adopt some new mindsets. We've got to have long-term time horizons for government budgeting. You know, we can't continue to think about property risks in a year-to-year basis. Just like we think about age pensions over a long time horizon, we need to think about these costs to the government over 30 or 40-year periods. We have to get proactive with building codes and land use planning. It's not good enough for us to simply be building to the elevation required 10 years ago in coastal areas in the U.S. at least. We need an investment bank approach to mitigation and coastal retreat. The house that John showed that had been flooded 40 times, think about it. It would be cheaper for the government to continue to insure that house at a massive loss than to buy it in this fiscal year, because they'd have to pay the entire value of the house this year instead of a probability that it would be damaged in the future. That really requires a completely different way of thinking about how government budgets are constructed and how we account for buyouts of property. And if we don't do that, the government's going to have to expense buyouts of property in the current year, and they won't do it, even if it makes sense over 20 years. We've got to think about a stochastic perspective on future states. And we can't simply assume the future will look like it does today. And once again, I think we need new building code paradigms. As I learned with the realtors undoing our good work on the mitigation guide in Florida, we've got to respect and work with entrenched economic interests, be they fossil fuel owners who have massive amounts of coal underground, that the value of which is destroyed if we go electric, or be it realtors, local councils, etc. You know, they're not bad people. They're just acting in their interest, and we have to respect that. And we've got to understand human psychology. You know, how was it that George Bush ignored the report on his desk that said New Orleans would be underwater, you know, the next time a hurricane came through the Gulf? That report was sitting on his desk. Of course, it was there under a pile of Iraq stuff, so little wonder it got lost. But, you know, we do need to understand the psychology of people when something hasn't happened, etc. And we need patience and persistence. Last comment, if we build things designed for a century of use, we better have a planning horizon considering things over the next century. If any of you are interested, I've got two articles that describe everything in this talk that I published in the Academy of Actuaries magazine. It's at my website on osgater.com. Thank you very much. Thank you.